Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. At this time of year, monarch butterflies flutter through the St. Louis region on their way to Mexico, where they spend the winter in warmer, sunnier weather. But there have been fewer and fewer of them making that journey. In fact, there's been a 90% decline in the number of these winged insects migrating in the last two decades. What's behind this alarming trend, and what's being done to save the species from becoming extinct? Joining us to talk trends and efforts to turn things around, we have Chris Hartley, Manager of Living Collections, Education, and Facilities at Sophia M. Sachs Butterfly House. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you for having us on.
And we also have Tierra Curry, Senior Scientist with the Center for Biological Diversity. Tierra, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm so happy to talk about monarchs.
So, yes, monarchs, they're migrating now through St. Louis, right, Chris? How many have you seen this year?
Yeah, so in line with the trends, our personal observations, myself and the other staff at the Butterfly House, have been that we're seeing very few of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you mentioned, this is common and alarming to everyone.
And how many should we be seeing?
Mm-hmm. Historically, you would see millions of monarchs. And people have these fond memories of their childhood, just seeing them pass over their land, spend the night in the trees of their property, just where the tree would become orange with monarch butterflies.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that you grew up with?
So I grew up in Georgia.
Oh,
and
okay.
Here in Missouri, we are much more in the flyway than in Georgia.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So are you keeping count? You know, is there a ticker that those of you at the Butterfly House are kind of adding to get your own sense of how many monarchs are coming through?
There are organizations already in place that are collecting hard data, like you describe.
Mm-hmm.
Ours is more observational evidence, but many listeners may be aware of the Monarch Butterfly Tagging Program
mm-hmm.
that's been going on for a very long time, collecting mm-hmm. the hard data on the numbers that make it to Mexico.
Yeah. So, Tierra, you have some insight into the numbers. Last year, how many monarch butterflies were we seeing, and how many were we not?
So last year was the second smallest population ever recorded of the eastern migratory population of monarchs. The smallest was back in 2013, and there was just slightly more than half a hectare of trees covered in butterflies that winter. And last winter, there was less than a hectare, there was 0.9. And so that's about 2.5 acres of monarchs. They measure them by the amount of trees that are turned orange in their habitat in Mexico in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And that is about a 90% decline from the mid-1990s.
Mm-hmm. And they all winter in the same place, Tierra?
Right? It's so amazing. All of the monarchs east of the Rocky Mountains fly to the mountains of central Mexico for the winter. They go to these Oyamel fir forests that are above 10,000 feet, and the weather is cooler there, so they just cluster and hang out in the trees. They go into reproductive diapause. They don't fly around too much so that they don't burn off their body fat, because then they have to fly all the way north to the southern United States again in spring to lay their eggs and start the summer generation.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen it yourself by any chance down in Mexico?
I have, and it is amazing to stand in these beautiful fir forests and look up at the trees covered in monarchs, and when the sun comes out, they fly around, and their wings kind of sound like a river or like fall leaves in the wind.
Oh, wow.
I just burst into tears. It's pretty much the most beautiful thing I've ever experienced.
Mm-hmm. So if you can, Tierra, for us, sort of put into context, you know, these numbers from last year and this year, there have been declines in the last two decades, right?
Yes, over the last two decades, the eastern migratory population has declined by about 90%, and a couple of things have contributed to that. One is the loss of milkweed. monarch caterpillars only eat milkweed, and so just urban sprawl and more pavement has gotten rid of natural habitats and prairies, but also increased use of herbicides and farm fields with genetically modified crops has wiped out a lot of the milkweed. And then climate change with unpredictable weather during the migration, whether it's too warm during the winter, big storms they have to fly through, cold streaks in the spring when they're flying north again, all of these things have just undermined the migration. And so some scientists think that climate change is now as big of a threat to them as herbicides and insecticides are.
Mm-hmm. So Chris is over here nodding and agreeing with you. Chris, when you speak with folks who are coming through the butterfly house, how do you talk with them about why they should care? Mm-hmm. It would be one thing to share all of what Tierra has said, but is there some way that you speak with people or you share stories that gets them on the side of, this is something I should be paying attention to?
People come to us frequently at the butterfly house already concerned about the monarch butterfly and asking how they can help. The monarch is a beloved insect to many, many people. What we try to share with people are meaningful impacts they can take around their home, and also to point out to them that the monarch is but one of many insects that all depend on us and are all affected by the factors that Tierra was just outlining for us.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things people can do on their own property, even if they have a very small garden.
Mm-hmm.
You can plant milkweed, but that's not all. Here in Missouri, monarchs will breed here, but they also depend, as they're flying south, on nectar-producing plants,
mm-hmm.
things like asters that are blooming this time of year. They have to fly all the way from southern Canada down to Mexico, eating nectar all the way. If that is missing along any part of the journey, well, you now have monarchs that are starving.
Right.
So they need that from us as well.
Mm-hmm. Chris, I think you're providing something for us to talk about the actual migration journey. And Tierra, I'm not sure whether what you described about seeing all of those butterflies in Mexico as a way to get people to maybe not necessarily to care, but at least to pique their interest. There are three species of monarch butterfly, and some of the monarchs that people see in other parts of the U.S., they stay put. The ones that we're talking about today, obviously, are the ones that are at risk of extinction, and these are the migrating sort. Can you describe, Tierra, what the monarch's migration journey involves, and what makes it such a fascinating and, frankly, astounding feat?
I would love to. And so they're all the same species. It's their behavior, whether or not they migrate or stay put and where mm-hmm. they are, that differentiates the population.
Mm-hmm.
So west of the Rockies, most of those monarchs overwinter on the coast of California. They have the same behavior as in Mexico. They cluster in the trees, but there's just far fewer of them than the eastern population. 99% of all monarchs are the eastern monarchs that migrate, that people see in their yards and grew up with and are so familiar with. And so the super generation is the last generation of summer, and they fly all the way from Canada to Mexico to overwinter, survive the winter, fly north again, and lay their eggs. And then the summer generations only live a few weeks each, and they fly north in search of milkweed as summer progresses. And so the miraculous thing about this is that four or five generations later, the last generation of summer, they've never been to Mexico. It's where their great-great-great-grandparents were, but somehow they find their way back to these same small forested areas high in the mountains. And
mm-hmm.
it's one of the longest insect migrations, and it's a multi-generational migration.
Right.
It's just amazing.
So as far as, that journey, the number of generations, and what we're looking at now, unfortunately, monarchs have also migrated to endangered status, and that is something that's actually being evaluated by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Now, Tierra, this is something that you've pushed for the past 10 years. Do you believe that this is the year that monarchs will be recognized as endangered?
I do. So we petitioned for the Center for Biological Diversity and other environmental organizations filed a scientific and legal petition with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2014, when the population was the smallest ever, asking them to protect them as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. And so by the end of the year this year, the Fish and Wildlife Service is supposed to propose them for protection as threatened under the ESA. And hopefully that will bring a recovery plan and more resources for the forest in Mexico, more impetus to plant a migratory corridor for them that's safe from pesticides and has those nectar plants that they need to fly north and fly south so that we don't lose this amazing migration.
And what is the criteria that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service uses to determine this endangered designation, Tiara?
So they look at all of the threats to the species, and there's certainly no shortage of threats to monarchs. And they also look at the population status. And it was a terrible year last year, and based on what we're seeing this summer, they just haven't rebounded, and it's going to be another terrible year.
What are the kinds of conversations, Chris, you have with your colleagues at, you know, it's called the Butterfly House, but the kind of conversations you have specifically about monarch butterflies?
Sure. So we talk about being able to have a message of hope that we can share with people. Because as you, as a homeowner, consider, right, what can I do when, you know, we really need, as Tiara was rightly saying, a safe corridor between Canada and Mexico. And I have one house here in St. Louis, right? What can you really do? Well, you can commit to not using herbicides and insecticides on your property. You can plant these native perennials, milkweed and fall blooming native perennials. You can talk to your friends and others you know who are also concerned about this. Share what you know. You can get involved with the conservation organizations that are, you know, actively engaged in doing some more serious conservation work. There's quite a lot we can do. And, you know, talking about it is always a good first step.
And speaking of talking about it, we have a call from Susan, who is in Edwardsville. Susan, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Hi, thank you.
Of course.
I have lots of wild asters. The plant looks kind of like a weed most of the time. It has a lot of little things sticking out. But then it blooms out into a wonderful little tiny blooms all over the plant. And they grow. They're rather prolific. Are they good for the monarchs? Are they helpful?
Okay. Yes, Susan, thank you for calling. Chris?
Yes, those are one of the best plants you can choose for your yard for the monarchs, because right when they do erupt into blooms is when the monarchs are passing through our area and when they desperately need nectar from flowers so they can refuel on that long journey.
Is there something about the aster that attracts the monarch in a particular way?
We've used it as an example just because of the time of year it blooms. There are other plants that bloom this time of year, goldenrods, for example, one that many people do think of as a weed, but is a valuable nectar and pollen source for pollinators.
Yeah. And are there any things perhaps we can plant now for, you know, this year's or perhaps for next year's group of migrating monarch butterflies?
There is many, many choices, and any nursery that stocks native plants or native wildflower catalog or native plant cell you might visit will have dozens of plants that would be great. What you want to look for are plants that bloom in September and October, of which there are several. Those are the ones that fuel migrating monarchs.
So, Tiara, I do want to get back to what we were discussing around endangered status. I mean, if it is the case that over, you know, a couple of decades, we've seen such declines in the number of monarch butterflies. What are some of the roadblocks or the hurdles to getting them on the list of endangered animals?
So one of the biggest roadblocks is just how backlogged the Fish and Wildlife Service has been, mostly because of political reasons. But because we're 10 years out, we're through the backlog, so we're to the point where they have priority to be protected. And one of the important things about protecting monarchs is that creating habitat for them is going to protect hundreds of other pollinators, native pollinators, and ones that aren't as pretty or as popular. Like, we like to say that monarchs are a gateway bug because they're so pretty and people like them, and they get them interested in insect conservation in general. And then you have kind of umbrella protection for all of the pollinators that, you know, we're so dependent on for the food supply.
Well, gateway is certainly pertinent to where we are here in St. Louis. Now, these monarch population numbers are alarming, and they are on a downward trend. But are there any recent bright spots or, you know, reasons to be optimistic, Tiara?
Well, one thing monarchs have going for them, as Chris said, is everyone loves them. So we're very committed to making their situation better. Another thing is they are going to get proposed for protection this year, so that will help. And then in Mexico, one of the threats to them has been avocado farming.
Mm-hmm.
Avocado farming is very water intensive, and the people who are doing it are cutting down the forest where the monarchs go for the winter to export avocados to the U.S. because they're so lucrative. But now the state of Michoacán is looking at a certification program so that lands that have been recently deforested won't be certified to export avocados to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So they just came up with this. It's too early to say it's going to be effective, but it's really good news because it would help protect their forests in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Now, this year, more people here in the St. Louis region, they've been calling attention to a lack of another type of insect, fireflies, or, you know, depending on where you were raised, lightning bugs. Are the challenges that fireflies face similar to those of monarchs, Chris?
In many ways, they are. I mean, they have a different habitat, different needs than monarch butterflies, but it's habitat loss, climate change, and chemical use.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those same things are a threat to insects everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And as far as some of the things that we can do, there is a perennial debate that comes up in the fall, and that has to do with raking and bagging leaves. Is that something that, you know, if folks are visiting the butterfly house, do you recommend anything one way or the other?
Yes, we have a very strong program advocating for people to dedicate portions of their yard to let leaves accumulate, to intentionally use logs and stones and other havens for these important insects. Quick firefly biology lesson is their babies live in decomposing leaves and under logs.
Oh.
I don't know if anyone's ever thought about a baby firefly,
yeah,
but they have a life cycle like a butterfly where a little larva turns into a firefly.
Mm-hmm.
Those larvae live in the leaves, sometimes for more than 1 year,
yeah,
which means they need undisturbed leaf litter for sometimes up to 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow,
that's why people argue to leave the leaves, because if you let them sit there for a few months and then rake them all up, you may not have done provided enough lasting habitat.
Mm-hmm. Tiara, how do you respond to that? Maybe especially for those who are, you know, more concerned about aesthetics than they are about leaving out some fallen leaves for fireflies and other insects to utilize.
Well, I think we've made some progress in recent years in just helping people be more comfortable with sort of the concept of a messy yard. And that's so important for the fireflies, for the birds, for amphibians like salamanders. But also a lot of butterflies either overwinter in the leaves themselves as adults, or their eggs or cocoons overwinter in those leaves. So when you rake up your leaves and send them off to the landfill, you could be throwing away Luna moths or hair streak butterflies. And also the carbon that would be stored in those leaves in your yard is going to be compressed in the landfill, and landfills are like a source of carbon, which promotes climate change, which threatens them. So it actually helps everyone all around to leave the leaves. And I try to be really nice to my neighbors because I leave the leaves. So
is there a way to compromise? I mean, could you leave sort of an artistically arranged pile of leaves in one part of your yard, Chris?
Well, you can actually do some raking when the leaves first come down to preserve your grass, and you can use them in your garden beds as a kind of natural mulch. Many people, you know, have large areas set aside for gardens, And, you know, many organizations will recommend just putting the leaves into there and letting that be the place where they accumulate. Mm-hmm. Many people who come to us at the Butterfly House don't already have an area set aside. And we ask them, could you set aside a corner of your yard to become a wildlife refuge like this? Mm-hmm. And from this point forward, it won't be grass. It will be leaf litter. And that just builds up year after year.
Mm-hmm. What about pesticides? Is there something that you offer, something that is constructive about how people can use something else that is not of the chemical variety, Chris?
Well, this does come up a lot when we do classes for people because people are very familiar with pests on their plants. The first thing we ask people is to just take a look at their plants and challenge them to observe and say, if you don't spray those aphids or whatever off your plants, do your plants suffer? Mm-hmm. Because we know from caring for our native gardens at the Butterfly House that they can coexist with the pests that people want to eliminate on them.
Chris Hartley manages Living Collections, Education and Facilities at Sophia M. Sachs Butterfly House, and Tiara Curry is Senior Scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity. Tiara and Chris, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up, how high school girls flag football is winning games and hearts in Belleville, Illinois. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
This episode was produced by Emily Woodbury.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.